Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And today, I have a great guest on. I've been dying to talk to him, and he's going to be coming to our conference. His name is William Barnes. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Now, can I call you Bill, or do you prefer William?
Sure. Bill is fine.
Okay. Bill, let's talk a little bit about who Bill is, what you do, and what prompted you to start doing all this investigation stuff you've done?
Well, I guess the shortest answer is that sometimes you find yourself getting into a field of investigation for a lot of reasons that maybe on the surface have no relationship to the field of investigation. From a professional standpoint or a business standpoint, that 15 or so years ago, and I still am, but I mean going back 15 or so years, I was a literary agent and literary rights agent, intellectual properties agent in Los Angeles, working for New York publishers and working for Los Angeles motion picture companies. And in the course of dealing with one of the motion picture companies on a project that was not related to UFOs at all, the person that we were talking to about putting together his rights, because he happened to know the project was American POWs and MIAs that were held back in wars, specifically the Vietnam War, but also World War II and the Korean War. And this one person was the negotiator for the United States for the exchange of prisoners at the end of the Korean War in 1953. He worked for President Eisenhower. His name was Philip Corso, and he was a lieutenant colonel in the Army at the time. And in the course of working with him and other authors, one of which was a CIA station chief and somebody else, Jim Sanders, who wrote the book on TWA Flight 800, Corso mentioned that one of his jobs when he was in the Army, after he had negotiated Operation Little Switch, Big Switch with the North Koreans, was that he was in the Foreign Technology Division of Army R&D, and one of his jobs was really to be a bag person, to take material that his commanding officer, Arthur Trudeau, Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, had put in his office from the crash at Roswell. And we were stunned, and he said, "But my job was to take this debris, it was just pieces of technology, crashed wreckage, and take this to various aerospace companies and defense companies, defense contractors, who were working on similar technologies that we could determine. We didn't know everything. We just knew that certain things looked familiar. And we didn't know what they did or how they worked. Take them to these companies and see if they could find out what the lowest common denominator was of that technology and use it to get a jump start in what they were working on. There were fiber optic cables, cables carrying light in this thing. And there were integrated circuit boards and things like that. And that's what he did. And that book became the day, and I worked with him. And the book became the day after Roswell. I wasn't supposed to write it, but the publisher, Simon & Schuster, said, "No, you really have to write it. You've written about five books for us so far, so you write this." We did, and that's how I got started in the field. The people who owned UFO Magazine at the time, in the 1997, had done an interview about the day after Roswell book, and an interview with me, and an interview with, I think they talked to Corso, and said, "Look, we're in financial straits. We need help. You look at this big motion picture company that you're working for. I was just an agent for them. And will you help us get financing from them?" And the company bought them and years later sold the magazine back to me. And that's how I got into UFO Magazine. From there, we began doing work with the History Channel on UFO files, because some of our authors, the History Channel would contact us and say, "Look, you've got an author who is an expert in Russian UFOs over the Soviet Union. Could you could you put us in touch with him? And eventually I said yes, and they said, could you give us a few quick quotes on camera? I said yes, and eventually I began doing the old UFO files for History Channel. I did, I think, four or five of them. And then one of the articles in UFO magazine was by a person called Patrick Uskurt, who was living in Venice, California at the time, and he saw a UFO over Venice Beach, took a video of it, and he was so impressed by the video, and my wife Nancy, who's the editor-in-chief of UFO magazine, said, look, Pat, you know, people are saying it's a balloon. Why don't you go back to the beach with the same camera and in the same position, get somebody to launch a balloon, a silver disc-shaped balloon, and take video of that balloon, and then compare the video that you took of what you're calling a UFO, we didn't know what it was, just what you're calling a UFO, and the balloon to it side by side, and just why don't you see what the difference is? That way you could tell what the balloon looks like, what the features are of that balloon flight in the daytime, the way it reflects the sun, the way it moves with the wind, four or five different things. And then what the UFO looked like. Sure enough, Pat did it. It was very compelling, a split-screen video when he edited it. And we took that to this company. Nancy said, look, now that you have this, why don't you, Pat, go on the road and interview people who've seen UFOs, take their video, analyze their video, put it together with yours, and see what you get. And he did that. He followed her advice. And sure enough, he had enough video that we then took it to a number of production companies, especially the one that was doing the UFO files for History Channel. They loved it. They took it to the History Channel. History Channel bought it. We did a trial episode as one of the UFO files all the way back in 2005. And sure enough, by 2006, we got a pilot order from History Channel, which in the end of the year became a television series. And it was on the air for three or so years, two and a half years.
Now, Bill, you've gone to a lot of places and investigated a lot of, let's just say, so-called sightings. But have you ever been able, when you go to these places, come up with direct proof that something has been there, or yes, this is for real? Because I know, like, when you did the UFO series, I only got to see a couple of them because I don't really watch a lot of television. But they were very interesting, except the ones that I saw, I didn't really get to see a total answer to it, like, well, is this real or is it not real, and kind of left me hanging a little bit. So can you explain that maybe a little bit so the listeners will understand how that works?
Sure. We were able to make some definitive statements about incidents and sightings. We made some definitive statements about Roswell. We made some, because we interviewed certain witnesses and covered aspects of the Roswell case where what I consider to be, if not physical trace evidence, because that was removed by the Army in 1947, but we were able to trace where the evidence went and interview eyewitnesses who handled the evidence. Now, were we able to come up with where this thing came from? No. But our procedure on UFO hunters, which I think is a good procedure scientifically, is you entertain every single explanation you possibly can. That's conventional, okay? Every single conventional explanation. In the case of Roswell, was it a weather balloon? Was it a mogul balloon? Were these crash dummies? And you go through every single explanation that you can, and you use whatever evidence you can assemble to see, can we keep this explanation alive or can we dismiss it? In other words, you look for dispositive evidence that will literally dispose of an explanation. And in the case of Roswell, we did. Was it a weather balloon? Well, we looked and we said, well, how could a person like Jesse Marcel, who was the base intelligence officer in 1947 at the 509th, how could he mistake a weather balloon, a conventional everyday weather balloon, which was the first explanation, by the way? There was no cover-up at first, right? They went to the newspapers. How could he mistake a weather balloon for a flying saucer? That's pretty stupid, right? I mean, you've really got to be dumb to do that. And you look at the man's record, and Jesse Marcel had gone to radar school just a few weeks before the crash at Roswell.
Okay.
So at radar school, he would have been able to identify the material for a balloon, because what was the material for a balloon in 1947? Was it some exotic material, something new, strange material? No, it was neoprene rubber, the same material they used throughout World War II. And where was the balloon factory, by the way? We were told by an eyewitness it was right across the street in Roswell. So even staff sergeants, even NCOs who handled material would have been able to recognize a weather balloon. Certainly, a radar-trained base intelligence officer would recognize a neoprene rubber balloon. So we dismissed the weather balloon. Then years later, they came back with, oh, it was Project Mogul. What was Project Mogul? Project Mogul was a series of conventional weather balloons tied together to reach very high altitudes. So Project Mogul, the material in Project Mogul, was the same as the material in weather balloons. Oh, no, it was crash dummies we were testing. Yeah, it would have been crash dummies you were testing if it were 1949 or 1950, but you weren't using crash dummies in 1947. Also, why would you use crash dummies that were 4.5 feet tall? That was the body bags they used, eyewitnesses told us, at Roswell. Wouldn't you use at least 5.5 feet or 6 foot body bags? If you had crash dummies that you were trying to hide, crash dummies are just that. They simulate human beings. They didn't have them until the 1950s in that size. So that dismisses that. I mean, it's kind of like statutes of limitations in law. It's dispositive. Out the explanation goes. What's left? A Japanese balloon bomb. The Japanese had launched balloon bombs against the United States throughout World War II. Some of these things actually went off. Some of these things were laced with biological weapons. The Japanese were using WMDs against the United States in World War II. I mean, that's fact. Mm-hmm. And we were working with WMDs as well in World War II at Dugway Proving Grounds. That's a fact. So the point that I'm trying to get to here is that when you start working with various explanations, you can eliminate certain kinds of things, and we did. So what are you left with? Well, you're left with the possibility that if it's not a conventional aircraft, because there was nothing in it that was conventional, if it's not a weather balloon, if it's not some more exotic weather balloon that didn't exist in 1947, entertain some other ideas. Well, is it possible for it to have been a UFO? Doesn't mean it's intergalactic, doesn't mean it's from outer space or the planet Venus, just means it's a craft that's unconventional, okay? Well, now go with what evidence you have. And the evidence we had was eyewitness evidence from various individuals who were there, who basically described the different kinds of materials they handled. And none of the materials that were handled by these people were materials that were conventional. There was metal that bent. So when you look at all the eyewitness testimony, you come up with the fact that you're not dealing with something that's conventional. You still don't know what it is. It's a UFO. By definition, it's unidentified. So you have that. Then you go to, is there any evidence, in addition to the eyewitness evidence, where the validity of that evidence is just about unimpeachable? You could account for the history of that evidence all the way through the course of that evidence being introduced. And the answer is yes. In 2002, I believe, there were two authors, Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, who were interviewing the public information officer at the Roswell base, whose name was Walter Hout. Walter Hout's an important person because Walter Hout is the press officer. That's what a PIO is, public information. The press officer who released the very famous story, Army Captures Flying Disc at Roswell. Very famous story. Hit all the newspapers. He released that story. Very important. And for 60 years, he was saying, well, you know, or 55 years, he was saying, well, that's all I know, that my boss, Colonel Blanchard, told me to release that information. I released it, and that's it. And everybody suspected he knew more because he was very close to Colonel Blanchard. In fact, he told me at UFO Magazine that the two of them were like brothers. He looked at Blanchard as his big brother. Blanchard was a very famous Air Force officer, really famous. He was actually vice chief of staff of the Air Force. He went all the way to general. Really important, important guy. Now, here's an important guy who authorized the release of a very highly questionable press release dealing with UFOs. So it's actually, how do you put two and two together? I mean, if it's supposed to be that top secret. Well, as it turns out, Walter Haupt provided the answer himself, and he provided the answer in a deathbed affidavit. And this is what I mean by the validity, the substantiability of certain evidence. When you give a deathbed affidavit in court, that's considered some of the most credible testimony. And it's allowable, usually, if you can verify the fact that it's a deathbed affidavit, it's allowable simply because most testimony in court, if the witness isn't there, physically present in court, to give that testimony, it's considered hearsay and it's thrown out. And there are a number of exceptions to that hearsay rule. The big evidence is if it's a deathbed affidavit, if you swear as you're contemplating death, it's a statement made in contemplation of death. If you're staring at death and make that statement, a court generally finds that statement very highly credible and admits it. And there are a number of cases where victims of crimes, right? Victims of crimes, they've been shot, they've been stabbed, they're dying. They name the person who committed the crime against them. Well, a court generally treats that as eyewitness testimony and admits the testimony. Well, in this particular case, Walter Haupt swore out an affidavit. He explained the whole Roswell story, explained the cover-up, explained everything. So even though we might not know exactly what the craft was, we certainly know that from eyewitnesses and from a deathbed affidavit, that this was not a conventional craft. Walter Haupt was at the site, handled the materials, saw the bodies, saw the body bags. I mean, so we now know, and we were able to determine in that show, yeah, we don't know where this thing came from, but we certainly know it wasn't conventional aircraft. It wasn't a balloon. It wasn't a mogul balloon. These were not crash dummies. That's what I mean by eliminating all the conventional things, looking at the nature of the evidence that's left, and making a determination. Now, in another show we did, it was the 1897 Texas Airship Mystery. It was exactly the opposite. We went through all the evidence, considered UFOs, considered flying saucers, went back to the history of the American Southwest from the 1860s to the turn of the century, found from certain newspapers, local newspapers, that there were lighter-than-air craft propelled by combustion engines, right? Lighter-than-air craft were invented in the 18th century. Napoleon used them. They were used in the Civil War for surveillance. But these were propelled by internal combustion engines, basically gasoline engines. And some of these were filled with hydrogen gas. Well, hydrogen, as you know, explodes. Gasoline engines have a lot of fumes. So in this one particular case, this one craft was, and a lot of these American sportsmen, this is a big American sportsman thing in the late 19th century, flying these internal combustion engine gas-powered gondola attached to balloons across the country. In one case, a group was going to fight the Spanish in the Spanish-American War. They were going to Cuba. And this one craft set down in Stephenville, Texas, days before a craft hit the water tower, the windmill well pump at this one judge's ranch, the Proctor Ranch in Aurora, Texas. Well, that was a theory, right? It was a theory. Why would a UFO hit a windmill? I mean, that's pretty stupid, right? These things travel 8 million light years. It's not going to hit a windmill that's 50 feet in the air. So there was something wrong about that. But, okay, you consider it. But now we knew they were lighter than air, just from newspaper reports, mm-hmm. right, that there were lighter than air craft flying around Texas in the 1890s. So then you go to the actual ranch. Okay, was there really? People said, no, there never was. It was a myth. It was fake. We went to the owner of that property and said, where was your old well? Oh, it's right here. And there's a little pump house sitting on top of the well. Okay. Is there a well down there? Yes. Can we dig? We'll pay for the crew. We'll make it right again. We basically brought in a backhoe, brought a drilling crew. Lo and behold, we found the well. There it is, the well, the famous well from the airship mystery. Well, could we find anything in the well that basically would have been from a craft? Pat Uskert went down in a diving suit and lowered into the well. Sure enough, brought up dirt, and the owner of the property gave us aluminum. It was aluminum that had been recovered from the well when the owner of the property closed the well up. Then the issue was, the owner of the property, this guy's grandfather, drank water from the well. It was alien water tainted from a spaceship. Oh, and his whole body exploded. It is, you know, he looked like he had limbs, hands were exploding. No, it was a genetic issue that the grandfather had. The son told us all about it. He himself drank water from the well when he was a little kid and didn't have anything wrong with him, nor did his father. So we dismissed the alien water business. Why did he close the well? Did he close the well because the alien spacecraft had contaminated it? No, because the pipes had rusted and they dug a new well. So we're going through all the history. Finally, we get to the physical trace evidence of what might have gone down there. The son gave us pieces of aluminum. Well, what could we do? We took it to a laboratory, and sure enough, it was aluminum. But it wasn't modern aluminum. It was a different alloy of aluminum, and we identified the alloy as aluminum manufactured in the late 19th century to the early 1930s before World War II. So we had a historical event that we could account for, airships crashing in that area, airships traveling in the area. We found the well. We found the pump. We spoke to eyewitnesses. We actually found trace material in the well. Then we analyzed the water in the well. Lo and behold, the muddy water at the bottom of the well had trace aluminum, and we were able on a mass spectrometer to determine that it was from before 1930. Yeah, so there's a case where we went after an airship mystery, thinking, oh, it's the first UFO crash in the U.S. No, it was a crash of a lighter-than-air craft. So two cases, right? Basically 40 years apart, 1897, 1947, mm-hmm. And two different things. One, we believe it was a flying saucer at Roswell. The other, we believed it was a lighter-than-air craft in Aurora, Texas, both in the American Southwest. But both decisions arrived at on the basis of taking every single conventional explanation and going down the rabbit hole with the explanation, looking for evidence, at the end of the day, coming up with the most plausible, not definitive, but the most plausible conclusion. And I could go on and on through 36 episodes, 39 episodes, but it would take all week. But that's exactly what we did.
See, and that's real important, because a lot of people who still want to disbelieve, including our government with their cover-up, that they don't exist, they're not here, not been here, and it's just all made up.
Well, our government knows they exist. I mean, that's the other thing, too. There are literally, and this is what I'm going to be talking about at the Wake Up Now conference, that when we approach it on UFO Hunters, and when the way we approach it on UFO Magazine, because UFO Hunters came out of UFO Magazine, when we approach this, we looked at, let's just say, four basic prongs of argument and evidence. It was basically eyewitnesses, physical trace evidence where possible, government documents substantiating either a particular case or UFOs in general, and then this doctrine. This doctrine is something that somebody from one of our clandestine agencies told me, and it's generally this, and I love it. It's the more different people scream that something is wrong, the more what they're screaming about is probably right. In other words, when government bends over backwards to explain why something can't be, okay, generally speaking, go in the opposite direction. Here's my concrete example. It's a non-UFO example, okay? Mm-hmm. In 1997... in July, a 747, a TWA 747, mysteriously exploded over Jamaica Bay off Long Island out of Kennedy Airport. Okay? And I remember watching that night. Oh, it's so terrible. 230 people died. It was really horrible. And it was a mysterious explosion. Oh, the wing tank, the whole center tank, the fuel tank just exploded. Well, Then this mysterious announcement came on from the United States Navy. They said there is absolutely no proof whatsoever that the United States Navy fired a missile at that plane. Now, that's like the police stop somebody in a car, right, for running a stop sign, and the guy says, "I didn't commit the murder." What murder didn't you commit? You know, suddenly the person admits to not committing a murder when there's no murder being investigated. That raises a red flag. So when the Navy said, "We didn't shoot down the plane," hey, nobody said you did. Why are you bringing it up? Then the more you investigate the case, the more you find out, hey, wait a minute. Why was there a hole in the side of the plane the size of a missile? Why was there the residue of guided missile fuel on the seats of the plane? Why in the history of the Boeing 747, a plane that's been flying for well over 35 years, is this the only single instance of a center fuel tank exploding on its own? Right? I mean, the whole point of science is repeatability. If there's a problem with a center tank on a Boeing 747, where it explodes, don't you think the FAA would ground these things and say, you fix that problem, you figure it out and fix the problem. I don't care what you have to do, but these planes are grounded because you could be flying over the Atlantic Ocean as Flight 800 was. The plane explodes and people die. Well, we don't want that. That's we're in the business of keeping that from happening. So my point of all this is when government says something and the explanations they gave were so implausible that finally one of the people, just in a Richard Feynman move, in one of the people took jet fuel, heated jet fuel. This is at a press conference. Took heated jet fuel in a Petri dish. Heated. So it's not cold fuel, by the way. If you know diesel fuel doesn't spontaneously ignite, okay?
Right.
It's got to be under pressure. It's got to be hot. So he takes heated jet fuel. He lights a cigarette and puts it in the jet fuel. Well, everybody ducks. The cigarette goes out. Why? Because it's not going to ignite. My point being, and that was, you know, if you remember the Challenger disaster, right? Mm-hmm. This scientist, Richard Feynman, said it's the O-ring. It's the rubber O-ring that gave way under the harsh temperature. Oh, Dr. Feynman, you're wrong. Oh, Dr. Feynman, you're an idiot. Oh, Dr. Feynman. So what did Feynman do? He took the rubber from an O-ring at a meeting of press, right, and congressmen, people, investigators, and plunged it into a glass of ice water, then smacked it on the table, and the thing shattered. Literally the explanation for the Challenger explosion on the launch pad. Where I'm going with this is that government, the screaming of government at why something can't be, usually is an indication that it really is. So in the case of UFOs, the government screams and screams that it can't be. Idiots who are really working for the government in some cases, not everyone, but some of them, working for the government, their cutouts, go on the air and say these really idiotic things that are implausible on the surface, and yet people like to believe them. Think about the Phoenix Lights, another phenomenal UFO incident from 1997, right? The Phoenix Lights. Here's a case where thousands of people saw this craft, documented sightings of this craft all the way from Henderson, Nevada, right to the Mexican border, that whole night of the 13th. But people had seen this thing earlier. People had seen this thing years earlier. Nobody knew what it was, right? So skeptics come on and say, oh, Fife Symington, the governor of Arizona, at first has this hokey press conference making fun of people who saw this thing, right, by having an alien, by having his chief of staff show up in an alien costume. But later on, years later, admits on UFO Hunters, by the way, on our television show, he admits that he actually saw the lights at 8:30 from his own backyard after he dismissed his state police bodyguards. He saw this, and he apologized for saying, I did a stupid thing. I was trying to make light of it. It was wrong to do. I apologize for the people of Arizona. I apologize to all the people who saw this. I saw it, and I am here to confirm that what this was not. It wasn't a conventional craft. It was not a balloon. It wasn't flares. And he went on to say that he was an Air Force officer. He had seen a strange blip on radar that he was told to ignore, and that from what he saw that night floating past him, he said it was a structured object, a structured object. He was directly under it. He saw stars coming through it in a wavy motion, which told him there was some kind of a cloaking device or some kind of invisibility device, probably a cloaking device. Is a cloaking device extraterrestrial? Actually, we have cloaking devices. The British have one. The United States has one. Big deal. We can have it. And it was actually coming through. I mean, we have one for our troops. We're testing them in Puerto Rico right now. So he basically said, so for all the people who said we saw these things, Fife Symington said, I was in the Air Force. I know what we have. Not only do I know what we have, but as the governor of Arizona, I was the commander-in-chief of the National Guard, and the Air National Guard. So I called my officers as their commander-in-chief and said, I order you to tell me what this is. And they said, sir, we have no idea. It's not one of ours. We're not flying anything. All the bases are not flying anything, and that's it. Well, that's so for a skeptic to say the reason the Phoenix Lights couldn't be a real UFO, well, it is a UFO because it's unidentified, but the reason it couldn't be anything other than flares or something is that different people, some said it was a structured craft, some said it was they only saw lights. So that means, now get the logic of this, some people only saw lights, some people only believe there was a structured craft that they saw. I've spoken to the people who saw the structured craft, Lynn Keitai, Terry Mansfield, Fife Symington, and others. They saw a structured craft. But this one skeptic says, oh, no, that's their mental set. They're adding the structure to it because they believe the lights weren't moving. They didn't add structure to the craft. They described the craft as satiny, as silky, as something they could have thrown a stone at because it was so close. Now, but what this person is doing is saying, I'm going to give everybody who wants to dismiss this a reason to dismiss it. It's not true, what I'm saying. It makes no logical sense, because if you're looking at it from one angle and somebody else is looking at it from another angle, the person looking at it from a particular angle might see a structured craft. The other person wouldn't see a structured craft because he's looking at it from a different angle. That's all. That's the answer. Not it can't be a structured craft because.
Yeah. Why do you think there's been so many sightings going on as of late? I mean, they're showing up everywhere. And yet some of the governments are actually openly saying, yeah, it was here, and still some go, no. But they're showing up everywhere. So why do you think, Bill, that there's more of those coming?
I think there are two reasons. One reason possibly is that there are simply more UFOs, right? But the more obvious reason, to me at least, is that there's more reporting of the UFOs. I mean, I think that UFOs are very common. I've said before that I think that UFOs are a lot like serial killers. They hide in plain sight, and nobody wants to admit they're there. I mean, my professional writing career in nonfiction really began with true crime. It began in business and computers, but then true crime. And one of the cases that I wrote about was the Ted Bundy case in the book Riverman, which later became the motion picture, The Riverman. And it's an instance where when you look at what police do, and we have examples of this from the Beltway shooter a few years ago, where our police will be inundated with clues that this guy's in plain sight, and yet while they're being inundated with clues, they're always looking the other way because the last thing they want to admit to is something they can't stop. They can't stop a serial murder scheme until they get lucky, okay? Mm-hmm. And getting lucky means having enough people in the field doing the legwork either to get a clue or whatever. When you look at the records, the cold case records usually, but the case records of a serial homicide investigation, people like Bundy and John Wayne Gacy and Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer up in Washington, when you look at those cases, the Atlanta child murder, and you begin to put the pieces together of the case and match them up with the individual who turns up, what you find out is that the name of the killer has been in your witness database, whether it's on index cards filed in a shoebox, whether it's in somebody's desk drawer, whether it's in a computer database, it's been in that database the whole time, okay? All you've got to do is find a way to go through all the files, see how many mentions of a name in various categories turns up. That's how they identified Mundy. In various categories turns up, match it up, and investigate the background of that person. The prototypical case was the Ted Bundy case, where when they began match, when they found him, and they found him only because he was stopped in Salt Lake City by a sheriff's officer. He was in law school at Brigham Young, I think. They stopped him because he was, at first they noticed him, he was driving around with one headlight out. So the officer was going to give him a, you know, a warning for the headlight or a summons. But Bundy saw the cop and fled. So now you've got a police chase. During the police chase, Bundy threw material out the window of his VW. Well, the police noticed that it was burglary material, you know, black masks and ropes and stuff like that. Uh-oh, that's it. That's having that material for burglaries is a crime in the state of Utah. So they arrested Bundy, brought him into court, and at the time, the state of Washington was undertaking a multi-jurisdictional investigation of this of the Ted murder. Somebody called Ted was killing women in Washington in the 70s. And so they investigated this. And believe it or not, when they got the name Ted, having been arrested in a VW, and a VW is one of the vehicles that was the vehicle that was a suspect vehicle in these Ted cases, when they got that lead from Salt Lake City, they went back, they pulled Ted's file. He was already in the records, right? They pulled his file, and they began researching all the evidence of Ted's movements. And sure enough, in his very first victim, a young woman called Linda Healy in the University of Washington District in Seattle, it turns out that Ted Bundy was in her site. They were both in the same independent study psychology class. He was passing her in the halls. He knew he would have known exactly who she was because they had the same professor, right, in the same place. His cousin, Bundy's cousin, was one of her roommates. They were at parties together in her apartment, so he knew the apartment. And, of course, his cousin, because she was a roommate, they had the same layout of that apartment, so Bundy knew his way around the apartment. He sneaked into the apartment in order to commit the murder. Then they find out from Bundy's checkbook, right, from his bank records, that he was cashing a check in a Safeway or some supermarket the same exact time that Linda Healy was at the same cashier, the same register. In other words, he was stalking her on the days leading up to the murder. That's what I mean. All the evidence was there. You didn't, Bundy eventually confessed to the crime, but the point that I'm trying to get to is that all the evidence was there in the file. It wasn't a case of where do you get the evidence? It was there. So they had the name Ted Bundy. They had the name Ted Bundy linked to the Linda Healy case, his first homicide in Washington. They just didn't know they had it. Well, this is the case also with UFOs. The evidence of UFOs is overwhelming in terms of government documents, newspaper reports, news reports, in terms of the number of individuals who are very credible who've seen these things, airline pilots, police officers, army officers, people in the UFO investigation divisions in the armed services, right? The head of Project Blue Book admits to it. Alan Hynek was like, well, here's a case where we know they're there. The government knows they're there, but they're in plain sight. And why are there more UFOs or sightings today? Well, the fact is that the media is taking it a lot more seriously. Why are they taking it more seriously? Do they actually believe in UFOs or creatures coming to Earth from distant planets? Absolutely not. One of the seminal events was the Phoenix Lights, where for the first time you had so many people taking so much video that media came from all over the place internationally. Suddenly they were confronted by the fact that there was a lot of video. The government said, oh, well, it's just flares. Fine. And the story didn't die away. It percolated. Is it the first time that happened? No. In 1952, it was the same event over Washington, D.C., an event so intense And we have the records of this. This is not speculation. It's not Burns going wild on this. It is a case where we actually dispatched F-96 jet fighters from the Air Force to intercept the UFOs. So how much money did we spend intercepting UFOs? We had them on radar from three different locations. We had them spotted visually from the cockpits of F-96 fighters. We had them on radar. At the end of the day, when General Sanford, the intelligence officer of the Air Force, went on, confronted the press and said, oh, this was a big mistake. These were temperature inversions, false sightings, and broken radar. The country believed it, even though the people who were working for General Sanford, like Captain Edward Ruppelt, head of Project Blue Book, later wrote a book and said, absolutely not. These were real UFOs. So Phoenix Lights 97, Washington 1952, the exact same thing happened, only this time, and it was heavily covered by the media, only this time the media only took the government line because some people in the media felt they had to keep their access journalism alive. But in 2006, or 2007, the Chicago Tribune picked up a story, John Hilkovich picked up a story, that there was a UFO over O'Hare Airport at the United Terminal C, United Airlines Terminal C. Mm-hmm. And that's a collision alert. UFO over an airport means collision. Who reported the UFO? Was it some crazed person in a parking lot screaming, the world is coming to an end, UFOs are here? No. It was somebody in a, just look at this as an example of what I'm talking about. It's somebody pushing a jet back from a gate over to a maintenance hangar, right? When a ground crew personnel driving those little tractors that moves the jets around moves a jet, he looks up into the cockpit because the pilots in the jet have to have their hands off the controls, okay? We're not talking about they're doing it politely for the person. I mean, think about it. You suddenly bump your elbow into a throttle, turn a jet engine on, the guy gets sucked right into a jet engine. Of course, you've got to keep your hands off the controls. It's just logical. So he's looking into the cockpit. That's the job he has to do. It's a matter of law. He, through the cockpit windshield, sees a large circular thing, right, over the aircraft at mm-hmm. the terminal. He calls into the tower. Why does he call to the air traffic controller in the airport tower? Because he has to. It's a matter of law that if anything can possibly or potentially interfere with aircraft over restricted airspace, that somebody in the ground crew, the safety crew, must report it. So he calls into the tower. Calling into the tower means automatically there's a tape of that transmission. That tape goes to the FAA. The pilots hear the transmission. They look up. They see the UFO. Other people in the ground crew look up. They see the UFO. And the next thing you know, you've got a UFO incident over O'Hare Airport. Well, the United Ground Safety and United Airlines must follow up. So United follows up, and there's an exchange of emails. People are sending drawings of what they saw to United Safety, United Ground Safety through emails. So there's now this record of this UFO sighting and the conversations of the traffic about it. Well, this reporter picks up a story because people call him. Who calls him? Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hey, John Hilkovich, you're the travel reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times or whatever, or the Tribune. We have a story about a UFO over there. Do you know anything about this? Hilkovich says, hey, wait a minute. He investigates it. He catches the FAA and United in a lie. They deny anything ever happened, but he's sitting with the actual emails. Then when he says, I'm going to get a FOIA request against you, FAA, they immediately say, yes, we had a strange story of a UFO, but it turned out to be nothing. So they lie, then they tell the truth. United is caught on its own emails. They have to tell the truth. Hilkovich publishes the story, and his newspaper gets 1 million hits on a website. Suddenly, everybody turns around and says, hey, wait a minute. You publish a UFO story, and suddenly everybody's listening. Well, if I were Rupert Murdoch or somebody running the media of my own media company, I would say, hey, you know, what a way to get eyeballs on my website and on my newspaper. Suddenly, media begins to cover UFO stories. And so over the past 4 to 5 years, the point that I'm trying to make is that you're getting more and more UFO stories turning up in the media, so it might be that there's not more UFOs, there's simply more UFO reporting.
Okay. Yeah, which, I mean, I'm here in New Mexico, and yes, you are coming to the Wake Up Now conference in April. And the thing is, I named it that title because I want people to really wake up. I want them to know. I want them to open their eyes, get their head out of the sand. Now, I've only been in New Mexico for, like, it'll be 2 years in April, and I've seen all kinds of stuff down here. I mean, it is just, you know, and I love it because I can sit in my house and look up at the sky and watch them go by.
Mm-hmm.
Or at nighttime, I can look over by the mountain and see a huge white ball there that sits there that does nothing, and then for like 20 minutes sits there, does not move, and then all of a sudden starts shooting out red lasers all over the place and then immediately disappears. You know, I've seen all of these things. So it's like when people try to say that they don't exist, they're not here, it's like, well, folks, I hate to tell you this, but you got to really take your head out of the sand. I mean, this whole state is a history of UFOs. We've had several crashes here. We've had crashes in Socorro, Roswell, over by Aztec, Farmington, you know, Dulce. Dulce is a very unusual town here. So when you come, if you spend a little time here, we'll take you to some of the places that
as you know, we did a UFO Hunters episode in Dulce, and we did an Ancient Aliens episode in Dulce. And the things we can tell you about Dulce are unbelievable. I mean, it's not just that there's something inside the Archuleta Mesa. It is that the Native Americans of the Jicarilla Apache Nation, who live in Dulce, it's their reservation, they told us stories. I mean, it would turn your head around. One police officer, a tribal police officer, said that he would come up to the mesa, on top of the mesa. He'd actually you could drive up there. Difficult drive, by the way. I've done it. And I've walked it. I've walked the 8,000 feet up the up the mountain. It's tough. It's a tough walk. You get up there, and you look over the edge, and in some places it's a sheer drop, and some places you can, you know, you could roll your way down, supposedly. It's at an incline. And he has seen these strange hybridized animals, rabbits on monkey bodies. In other words, things that shouldn't be put together, put together.
Right.
We saw photographs of a human head on a cow's body in a fetus in a cow, taken out of a mutilated cow. Some kind of genetic experimenting, hybridizing experimenting is going on at Dulce that is frightening. And, of course, after we aired it on UFO Hunters, that photograph, three senators, Grassley, Graham, probably McConnell, introduced a bill in the Senate to amend Title 18, which is the federal penal code, to make it a crime, a federal crime, to interbreed humans and animals. Now, something is going on there. Are they creating the universal soldier? Are they creating some kind of an android bot, a biobot, a cyber soldier? Are they trying to come up with, remember, bovine serum is used to host human eggs in vitro fertilization. So are they creating entities, biological entities, that can host human eggs? Are they doing this for stem cell research? And who's doing it? Are these aliens? Is it the military? Is it big pharmaceutical companies? Whatever it was, it's spooky enough. And so this one tribal officer and the tribal police saw these hybrid animals, these strange animals he's never seen before. Then one night he's on the mesa, and he sees a convoy of black vans traveling, he said, towards Albuquerque. So he has no probable cause, by the way. He can't just stop and say, I'm here to investigate you. You know as well as I do that in order for the police to make a stop in the United States of America, to have any validity in court, there must be something called a probable cause. In a traffic violation, if you have a headlight out or a taillight out, that's probable cause. So but he knows something is wrong. So he stops the convoy, asks them where they're going at this hour of the morning, and he's trying to look, because if you stop somebody and say, this is suspicious, and you see something in plain sight, that basically overrides the need to get a search warrant. So he sees cages inside these vans. Cages. Can't see what's in them, But because he had no reason to detain, it's called a Terry stop, he had no reason to detain the driver of the van or the people in the van. He had to basically say, okay, fine, you know, they said we're going to a flea market. Well, that's going to a flea market, going to a flea market. That's what happens. It lets him go. But that's what's going on at Delcy. Something biological is going on there, whether it's aliens, the military, pharmaceutical companies, we don't know.
Well, see, the thing is that Delcy, because at the conference, and I want people to know this, because we can't keep talking, Bill, but at the conference, all of this stuff is going to be talked about, because I have 15 speakers coming from all over, and some of them investigated all kinds of stuff just like you. Mm-hmm. But they know about Delcy, Sandia Labs, Kirkland Air Force Base, White Sands Military Base, and how they're all connected and all the experiments that are going on. And it's scary. You know,
it is scary.
It's strange because, you know, they keep it so that they don't allow you to know what's going on. I've had people that I met here who had to go work over by Kirkland, and what they have done is they've hollowed out part of the Manzano Mountains, and they have all kinds of stuff down in there, and if you go there, they take you escorted with a gun, and they tell you, if you look up, we will shoot you. So, you know, think about it. There are a lot of things going on down here. So, you know, I'm going to just, you know, let everybody know again, Bill, that you're going to be at the conference and you're going to finish doing the talk like we're doing now, because this is really one conference that anybody who wants to know some true facts does not want to miss. And it should be really, really a great conference. And I can't wait to actually meet you in person. And like I said, if you stick around a little bit after conference, I'll take you to a few places that I know you might find a little interesting by my house. So.
Well, you know what? I'll be there, and if we have time, we should do it. Let's see some strange lights. Let's see what's going on there.
Yeah, it's really strange. But our time is up for right now, Bill, and I'd like to thank you for taking the time. I love the information you give out, and there are more information to come at the Wake Up Now conference. So thank you for spending the time with us right now.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much, and I will see you in a couple of months.
Great. Sounds great. Thank you, Bill.
Thanks.
I'd like to thank you, the listeners. I hope you enjoyed part of it. If you want to hear more about what Bill was talking about, be sure to come to the conference, because there's going to be a whole bunch of stuff talked about at the conference. It's the Wake Up Now Conference, wakeupnowconference.com. Bill's website is httpufomag.com or futuretheater.com. You can find Bill there. And again, Bill, thank you, and thank you all of the listeners, and have a great week.
Thank you.